But in the earlier times, in the 60s, 64, 65, we had a lot of Austrians come out here, and other people, some English people, and so on, for some reason, on a Sunday morning, and they'd go for a ride, which we called it the Mad Mile, and we'd take them for a gallop up this Mad Mile going up towards the coast, west from where we are, and we'd ride out to the coast and back in again, take about 3.5 hours, and they used to love it. And we decided we'd try and form some sort of a club, so we used this room we're sitting in now to start with. And then a Canadian ambassador came out one time, and he said, why don't you put a country club up out here? And I thought, oh, that sounds all very well. But he bought some brochures and showed me a brochure of one in Canada. And we thought, well, we'll look at it, and why not? So we got together, and it was myself to start with. And then I had some other friends, my then brother-in-law, John Green and Richard Bowie, Phil Very, Tony Keane, and myself, all got to work and decided to go for it. To start with, we didn't have enough money to pay for the bulldozing of the site. We chopped the 10-acre block off from here, and then we slowly built up a Hollywood-type facade on the outside, which looks like things were going well, so more people joined and more people joined. And in the end, ironically, most of the Austrian guys that were in the original scheme of things dropped by the way and didn't even become members. I think there's only one of them that stayed as a member. But the idea caught on, and 1973 we opened it, we completed it, and it was one of the first clubs in New Zealand which allowed women in as their own right as members. Hard to believe that short time ago that's how things were. You couldn't get a license, so we used a ticket system which all other clubs had used, and it was only a veneer of legality really. And we spoke to the police, and they said, we'll keep the nose clean and we won't notice it.
Sure. So how would such a system work?
A member would buy a book of tickets. Might be, in those days, I think there were 30-cent tickets. And you would purchase a drink with a ticket. So you just hand the ticket over. And you'd presumably take your drink, what was left over, if there's anything left over. If you bought a bottle, put it into your locker, and then use it. But we had a bar there which was served from, as did just about every single club in the country, and it became such a farce that the government of the day wanted to entertain the Rockefellers out here, the mayor of New York at the time, so they brought them out the country club, and they had to take the liquor through the back door. And there was we had a 7-year battle with the Licensing Control Commission of the time, who we feel were very, very much inclined towards the breweries. So much so we applied 3 or 4 times to get a license, and the last time the government had said, right, we're going to allow all sporting clubs to get a license, liquor license. So we went in first and applied for it, and they said, no, we don't think you're a sporting club, even though you've got a pool room and 2 tennis courts, squash court, the horse riding. No, you're not a sporting club. You're a dining out club. And it was obvious after that there was no way they were going to give us a license. So we lobbied with various politicians, and we got Rob Muldoon out, and we had a patriotic dinner up there and at the club, and we gave him a carborundum stone, a sort of little trophy, which was inscribed "Nil illegitimate et carborundum," which translates "Don't let the bastards grind you down." So as he went, he said, well, look, he said, this is a crazy set of affairs, we'll get you a license one way or another. So they did, true to his word, they made an act of parliament called the Winton Holdings Licensing Act, and we, it's what we called the company we formed to start the country club. And so we finally got a license, which we were virtually able to design ourselves, which fitted in extremely well. And unlike the breweries who had a 50-year monopoly on alcohol, we didn't have stabbings and anything like that taking place as there were in the kind of swill barns they operated by and large at the time. And we had families going up there on the weekends and using it as a family club, and businesses using it during the week. And the sort of businesses were big oil companies and Kodak, Reader's Digest, most of the large companies around all joined. And we ran it for 10 years. It was going great. It took 7 years to get the license all sorted out. And then the fire department came along and said, well, you've got we want 2-hour fire rating jib board on these walls because you've got liquor here now. Well, this is a crazy situation. I don't know what the devil that, you know, had to do with things. But nevertheless, they said they want 2-hour fire rating jib board put on the whole place, which is going to cost about $250,000. So we went to the members and said, look, we don't want charity. If you pay $250 each, you can eat and drink this out over 12 months. So we had about a 10% response at that point. Just then, the Commercial Travellers Club in Wellington folded. It went to the wall, and people had debentures and that, and they lost their money, and that worried our members. So we thought, well, we've got nothing else to do here other than sell. So we sold it to a person we didn't know much about.
As a going concern.
As a going concern. Yeah. He turned out to have a few problems with the law and things like that, and which didn't bode well from the club's point of view. He was going to carry on running it. He changed the name of it and all sorts of things, and eventually just went into the ground, and it was sold by the bank, mortgagee sale. And he stripped everything out and sold all the furnishings off. Well, most of those furnishings we imported. We had velvet curtains from Germany. They're still there, fortunately. Specially designed carpets and light fittings from Spain. And we put a lot into it, and it was... so much so, a lot of people would come up and say, I think this is too flash for me.
Too,
I couldn't afford
opulent,
this.
Yeah. Yes.
Said, hey,
yeah.
This is crazy. Yeah. Even the Queen sits on the loo. You know, forget about it. Don't worry about it. You're as good as anybody else, as long as you behave yourself. And the sort of people we had there were from all walks of life, from sirs to carpenters.
So it was a very egalitarian club.
It was quite
different from some of the city clubs that we...
Absolutely. Yeah. Mm. There's nothing... too snobbish about it, and yet it still had a good class of member. Yeah. So we were more than happy with it, and it was a shame because we enjoyed it as much as any, though we didn't make a fortune out of it, we enjoyed it as much as the members did, and it was a wonderful period of our lives. And many members come up to me now saying, hey, they were great days, and wow, if you had it in 20, 30 years time, it'd be a boomer. Yeah. But That didn't matter too much. I guess it was a challenge, and it was pretty hard at that particular time because I was going through a marriage breakup, putting up the club, building the indoor riding school, and running what we have here. That took a fair bit, but I think people say you must be brave to have done that. Well, really, it's a bit like going out and treading water, and then you have to swim for it. There's no turning back. You've got to keep going, and there's no option. You've told all your friends about it. They've all joined. They've all put money up into it. Mm. What do? You've got to stick with it. Mm. So, that was the That was the country club.
How many members came into the club? I suppose when you have corporate members, it's sort of
we had a little different. About 400 to 500 members, and I think half of those were corporate members, and they could bring along up to 8 people or 10 people each. If they wanted to have more, then they could take out an additional membership and so on. So it was probably 800, 900 people. If you take, you know, the yes, for example, a husband and wife could join under one membership and both have a card each. So, and bring their children as well on the weekends, which the pool up there used to be, on the weekends it was extremely well used. And there's live music 3 nights a week. It was there's always fire going in the big lounge in the winter, and a
restaurant.
There were two restaurants. There was a restaurant downstairs, a small cafe type, for people playing squash and what have you. And there was a wine cellar down below there, which had bigger stock at the time, and there the most restaurants would have had. It was rather funny because, well, looking back on it now, the way back in the early stages, the Labour government formed a Royal Commission on Liquor, and they said, well, liquor shouldn't be sold for private gain. Well, the breweries have been doing that, like I say, for 50 years, but they had this all sewn up, and politically money was obviously given to both parties. It was amazing that National came to the fore, and it was probably Rob Muldoon's doggedness that did that, or his power, or whatever. Nevertheless, the police came and raided the club, confiscated, took away what they thought was all the liquor. Fortunately, we had another supply back a bit further. But when the police came in, the band that was on there the night played the pub with no beer as the police were walking out with it. So it was taken pretty lightheartedly.
When did that raid take place?
About 75.
75.
Round about there.
So quite early in the, relatively early in the country club's history, yeah.
But the irony of it, well, the funny part of it, was that most of the part-time people that worked and the full-time people that worked in the club were people from the valley here. And there were two ladies that went, as I did on that particular time, to the Parent Teacher Association, had a few drinks down at the school. And we were down there, and I'd heard about this raid taking place. So by the time I got back here, the police had gone, and so had the liquor. But we decided that what liquor remained, we better move out somewhere else. Otherwise, we'd have nothing for the members. So we loaded up 2 cars in the club van, and the front vehicle was in the driveway of the club, and the van was right by the door, and I was behind the van. And the guy driving the van said he's forgotten the keys. Now, just then, at that moment, 2 cars came at the bottom of the drive where we could look down and see, 500 metres away, and it looked like the police had blocked the drive. They'd come back, so we thought, okay. The guy took off to get the keys for the van because we were going to drive back behind the tennis courts and dump what there was up there then. But just as that moment, the 2 vehicles started to part and come up the driveway. So I thought, to blazes with this, he left the door open, so I drove through and wiped the door off the van and went round the back of back of the club. And I thought, well, they're not going to take everything, so I grabbed a case of wine and stuck it on my shoulder. I said to the other guy who was there, I said, come on, we'll go and drink this in the hills if we have to. But as it turned out, it was 2 women who'd been, it wasn't the police at all, they'd been to the school reunion that I'd been to and chatted about it side by side. One came in from another direction, rather, and they were talking about it. And so all that damage was caused for no reason whatsoever. Yeah. Big scrape down the side of my car, the door off the van, and but we still kept the liquor, so we managed to hang on to that. And one of the waiters was saying, I don't know if I can carry on doing this much longer. It was winter time then, and he said, I've got to go down the bank with an umbrella and find a bottle of wine for someone in the grass, sort of style. We had a little sort of a shed thing put underneath the building. So anyway, that was how the some of the things happened in the club. There was always an evening when, by this time, quite a few of the local farmers had joined as members and their families, and it became quite a meeting place for the locals as well. And each month there'd be some sort of a function. For one time we had a Chinese, big Chinese dragon from the Chinese club come out there, and Chinese food and so on. The chef we had in the kitchen was a guy called Roy Young, who's Chinese, and he started off the he used to have the Casablanca restaurant in town, then he got the Yangtze restaurant, and he put European food on as good as any European could, and he did a marvellous job when he was running it at the club. You know, went from strength to strength, and someone came in at 10 o'clock at night, it wouldn't bother Roy, there'd be a meal cooked up for them just like that. Anyway, so they were good times, and but that's the country club. Today it's owned by an Indian gentleman who lived there with his family for quite some time, Ash Bashin, and he's still there. His family's off his hands, and so they've got this big building, which had on the, as I say, downstairs was a little wine cellar, a good-sized wine cellar rather, and a little restaurant. You came upstairs to the main lounge, and then there was a squash court, a big fireplace in the lounge, a squash court and a plunge pool and sauna room, changing rooms and what have you. Then you went upstairs to where there was a boardroom for corporates wanting to have meetings and so on, with everything put on, flocked wallpaper and so on. And in the billiard room had two full-size billiard tables and two smaller ones, with beautiful stag heads and trophy heads around the place. A guy called Dion Savage, who had got trophy records for New Zealand, he put his heads up there. And so it was quite grand overall. And then outside you had the swimming pool, and two tennis courts, sorry. Yeah, that was the club.
That sounds most impressive, yeah.